The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've got a lot to get to on this first program of the week. Coming up later on in the show, we'll be playing my father's commencement address from yesterday at Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma. We'll be playing it in its entirety, an excellent message that he gave to all of the graduates and their families and the special guests that were assembled in Edmond, Oklahoma yesterday for the graduation ceremony. And also we had a nice-sized group here at Edstone that got together to not only watch the stream of all the events from yesterday, but to graduate three of our own as well. So as I say, we'll be playing that message for you later on today's program. Also, we'll talk a fair bit about President Trump's travels. He was in Saudi Arabia over the weekend and just touched down in Israel today, a few hours ago. So we'll have some pretty good sound bites from his travels, and have a fair bit to say, I think, also just about the Middle East in general. But first, I thought I just would circle back to something that I know we hit on pretty well last week, the media's concerted effort to bring down the Trump presidency. I just wanted to come back to it because of this comment made by Brit Hume on Fox News. This was, I think, sometime yesterday. This is clip one.
In the atmosphere in which we're now living, everything is likened to Watergate. Reporters, even some who weren't there at the time, would like to relive that.
And that got a little bit of a laugh. It went on to bring out. And I think, again, there's a lot of truth to that. If you go back to the program that we had, I think it was last Wednesday, it had the title, or Watergate in the title. And really, in so many ways, this is not like Watergate. But with respect to the media attack on a sitting U.S. president, I mean, in that sense, it's very similar. History repeating itself. Reporters would like to relive that, as Brit Hume just said on that clip that we played for you. Fox News had a piece that came out over the weekend as well about a new Harvard study that has found that, surprise, surprise, the coverage of Donald Trump and his administration has been overwhelmingly negative. The media coverage, it's been stunningly negative, this piece brings out. And this is according to a study by Harvard's Shorenstein Center. It's a widely respected operation. And it follows, or studies, media and media coverage. And in this case, it focused in on President Trump's first 100 days in office, and it analyzed the coverage in three of the major newspapers. You have the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. And then the major networks, CBS, NBC, CNN, and Fox News. And according to this study, coming out of Harvard, some 80% of the stories, some 80% of the news reports are negative in the coverage of President Trump. They have a negative tone. Only 20% have what could be considered a positive tone. And this article, or the study, also brings out how that it's twice as much negative coverage than what Barack Obama had in his first 100 years, but his first 100 days. So they compared the two, and of course, it's, as I think everyone would expect, it's very different, the approach that the major media takes today. The article, this is at Fox News, says at CNN and NBC, 93% of the stories were negative in tone toward Trump. The study says, put another way, their main newscast could find only 7% of stories worth being positive toward the president. CBS, it's the same, 91% negative. New York Times, 87% negative. It just goes on and on. I think Fox News is about the only one that's a little more level. And so they're happy to report this. I don't think you're going to get a lot of reporting on this study at those other sites, at those other news outlets, besides Fox News. It says here, it's telling that 96% of the coverage of immigration was negative, along with 87% of the coverage on healthcare. So the point it makes here further on is that the issues are important as well with respect to the coverage, because when it's about immigration or healthcare, here again, the major media, they have a very definite position that they think is right, that they think, you know, it should be something that we're pursuing as a nation. And then they cover it accordingly. And then notice this. It makes this this important point that we made last week. You know, besides the fact that there's this bias, this agenda, and so on, just look at the distraction that this is. The article says on the national networks study, 41% of the stories, I mean, this is just in general, 41% of the stories involve Trump. That means of everything going on in the world, more than 4 out of 10 stories dealt with this president, 3 times the usual level. So it's obviously negative coverage. Okay, that's a given. But then 4 out of 10 stories are about Donald Trump. And when you look at everything that's going on in this world, I mean, this is dangerous. This is dangerous for the United States, for the people of the United States. Totally oblivious to so much of what's happening in the world. Here are the news outlets, at least in the United States, and I'm sure that it's probably somewhat the same in the UK and some European papers as well. But here are all these news outlets just obsessed with all things Trump, even as the rest of the world is becoming more evil, more dangerous, and many regions in the world going up in flames. And then you add to that, of course, that the coverage is overwhelmingly negative. Pretty amazing. And we're only 4 months into it. Well, speaking of Donald Trump, he's on his first trip abroad. And I mean, this is significant news because he's taking, in some ways, a very different tone than President Barack Obama took early on in his presidency. And in other ways, as Brent Nachtigall brings out in a piece that was at the top of the Trumpet earlier today, I think it might be the second story now. But it's in other ways, I think, somewhat similar to what Barack Obama and others before him have taken, particularly with respect to Israel and the pursuit of a so-called two-state solution. I mentioned earlier that President Trump just arrived in Israel a few hours ago. Here's what he had to say at the Tel Aviv airport. This is clip 7.
We love Israel. We respect Israel. And I send your people the warmest greetings from your friend and ally, all of the people in the United States of America. We are with you. Thank you and God bless you. Thank you.
So that's not an unusual message to deliver, particularly on first arriving to the state. But go and look at Brent Nachtigall's piece today at thetrumpet.com. Will Trump push Israel too far in search of peace? I mean, as strong as the rhetoric was during the campaign season, we're going to be as strong with Israel as ever. We're going to back them. Unlike President Obama's administration, we're going to move the embassy finally over to Jerusalem. And then we get just a few weeks or a few months into the new administration, and we find that from the Trump administration, they don't want to see settlement expansion. Now they're deciding that maybe it's not the best to move the embassy. And then I think, as Brent brings out, what makes Israelis particularly nervous is this new president's desire to make peace or to come up with some kind of a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. Here's another statement from President Trump this morning, clip 8.
We have before us a rare opportunity to bring security and stability and peace to this region and to its people, defeating terrorism and creating a future of harmony, prosperity, and peace.
So he sees this as a rare opportunity, and I think we've played on this program previously that he really doesn't feel like it would be that hard to establish a peace agreement, some kind of a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. In Brent's piece at thetrumpet.com, he says the general consensus in Israel on the left and the right is that conditions are not currently ripe for a peace deal. This is not because Israelis don't desire peace, but rather because of the continual incitement to violence by the Palestinian leadership. The ongoing refusal of the Palestinian Authority to stop paying terrorists and their families for murdering Israelis, as well as the fact that there isn't a legitimate partner that represents all Palestinians for Israel to negotiate peace with. I mean, the president did welcome in Mahmoud Abbas to the White House a few weeks ago. But really, I mean, does he even speak for all of the Palestinian people when you've got the divide between Fatah and Hamas? Brent goes on to say here, mostly, though, because Israelis believe that the starting point of a negotiation should be Palestinian acceptance and recognition of a future Jewish state, something the Palestinians have yet to declare. See, they won't do it. They don't want to accept a Jewish state, whether it's the one that's currently there or one that would be downsized so that a Palestinian state could live side by side. They don't want that. They want to wipe out Israel. And so a lot of Israelis are a little bit concerned now because for as good as he sounded on the campaign trail, now you're getting a bit of a different message coming from President Trump and his spokespeople. Brent says, what worries Israelis the most about Mr. Trump is how personally invested he is becoming, in the peace process. He's even referred to it as the ultimate deal. I mean, he really wants to make this deal happen. And of course, he sees himself as a deal maker, like Brent brings out in the piece. And so this would be a major victory for peace. And so he's there to make it happen. And he wants concessions on both sides. And he's applying a lot more pressure on Israel now than he said, what he said he would when he was campaigning. Again, I won't take the time to play them for you, but you can go back probably to dozens of speeches last year where it was just the strongest sounding support, particularly the speech that he gave at AIPAC. I think that's embedded in Brent's article, by the way. So as I say, go to thetrumpet.com and look for his latest. Will Trump push Israel too far in search of peace? Well, before arriving in Israel, the president, as you probably saw in the news yesterday, he was in Saudi Arabia giving a speech before the Saudi leaders. And there have been some, again, who are attacking him in the liberal leftist media that have said, well, I mean, when you get right down to it, these two speeches are pretty much the same, referring to President Trump's yesterday and the infamous speech that Barack Obama gave in Cairo back in 2009. We had a lot to say about that particular speech. My father wrote how President Obama's Cairo speech will shake the nations. That speech, he said, is going to damage the United States. It's going to be irreparable. The damage. You compare these two speeches, really. And again, President Trump has definitely tamped down the campaign rhetoric, for sure. But on the subject of Iran, I mean, these two speeches couldn't be more different. President Obama in 2009, he as you probably remember, he didn't even mention terrorism. And in fact, he defended in that speech, he practically defended Iran's right to pursue nuclear technology. Didn't mention terrorism. Didn't talk about Iran being the number one state sponsor of terrorism. My father had this to say back in 2009. He referred to Charles Krauthammer at the time, who said that Cairo speech was the weakest statement on Iran and nukes in at least 8 or 9 years by anyone in the West. Quite a statement. It's the weakest statement you could make about Iran and nuclear weapons. My father says that sends a lethal message to the Middle East and the rest of the world. And he says here, and it's not what even the other Arab nations want to hear. He quotes another commentator, my father does, who said that the whole Arab world is scared to death of Iran. So this is not something that even the other Arab nations want. To see an administration come in and try to establish peace, quote unquote, with Iran and to give them a clear path to build a nuclear bomb, this terrifies Iran's neighbors. My father says that is who President Obama was addressing in this speech. But he said nothing about confronting the king of terror in this world. So he was there in Cairo. He's addressing the Muslim and the Arab world, and he doesn't even bring up or confront the king of terror, or the head of the snake, the head of the terrorist snake. It says, considering what Iran is doing now, it should have received the strongest condemnation ever. But it got none of that in that Cairo speech. And then my father made this statement. This is one that we've repeated often. He said, President Obama thinks that through his words, he will have peace with Iran. But after the terrorists heard that speech, they had to be rejoicing. When America's president gives a speech like that, the terrorists have contempt for such weakness and are stirred to fight even harder. They can smell victory. So we can expect violent terrorism to intensify and shake the nations. Well, in his speech yesterday at the Saudi capital, President Trump repeatedly brought Iran up. He repeatedly attacked Iran. He said Iran's the one that's sponsoring terrorism around the world. Iran's the one that's guilty of all of these unspeakable crimes. And earlier, the king of Saudi Arabia, he had said that Iran was the spearhead of terrorism. Let me just give you a bit from what President Trump had to say in Saudi Arabia on Sunday. This is clip two.
For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this very room. Among Iran's most tragic and destabilizing interventions, you've seen it in Syria. Bolstered by Iran, Assad has committed unspeakable crimes, and the United States has taken firm action in response to the use of banned chemical weapons by the Assad regime, launching 59 missiles at the Syrian airbase from where that murderous attack originated. Responsible nations must work together to end the humanitarian crisis in Syria, eradicate ISIS, and restore stability to the region, and as quickly as possible. The Iranian regime's longest suffering victims are its own people. Iran has a rich history and culture, but the people of Iran have endured hardship and despair under their leaders' reckless pursuit of conflict and terror. Until the Iranian regime is willing to be a partner for peace, all nations of conscience must work together to isolate Iran, deny it. Funding for terrorism cannot do it. And pray for the day when the Iranian people have the just and righteous government they so richly deserve. The decisions we make will affect countless lives.
Okay, you didn't hear anything like that in 2009 in that Cairo speech. You never heard President Obama talk about how for decades Iran had fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. That was what you heard yesterday, and you can see why it was so well received in Saudi Arabia. And then look at how Iran came out and responded, saying, look, you better look at the extremists in Saudi Arabia. You know, most of the 9/11, those involved in that attack come from Saudi Arabia. You're just over there using us as an excuse to make this huge arms deal with Saudi Arabia. That's how Iran responded, mocking President Trump's speech and, of course, denouncing it every step along the way. But look, I mean, to our friends at CNN that can't figure out why Saudi Arabia would receive President Trump with open arms, even more so than President Obama, it's because Saudi Arabia, they know who the head of the snake is when it comes to terrorism. And they are, like my father quoted in that 2009 piece, the whole Arab world is scared to death of Iran. And so they welcome a new U.S. president, particularly one that would say something like what he said yesterday. Let me just play for you an exchange that was on CNN bringing up this point about the difference in the way they received President Obama as compared with President Trump over the weekend. This is clip 3.
Of course, Jeff, Trump said during the campaign, quote, Islam hates us. But he has received an extremely warm welcome in Saudi Arabia, much warmer than President Obama's last trip to Saudi Arabia, where the king wouldn't even meet him. Why is that?
Jake, it's so interesting. I mean, the rhetoric that he used, and in fact used to win the Republican primary campaign, and then when he was running in the general election, was so divisive. But it's almost as though that has either been forgotten or forgiven, largely because of the interest in resetting relations. The leaders here, the government here, likes the idea of his policies, at least largely how he has spoken out against the nuclear agreement in Iran, largely what they hope his policies will be. But Jake, so interesting, he's not delivered on any of that. He said he was going to erase it on day one. That hasn't happened. But they are embracing him here and indeed rolling out the red carpet, unlike President Obama had even 8 years ago during his first visit here in June of 2009. As we were driving through the streets of Riyadh, Jake, just the billboards of giant pictures of this president, a giant image of Trump on his hotel last night. He loves all of this, of course, and many of the foreign leaders he's been meeting with are showering him, you know, with congratulations. It is, of course, an attempt to reset the relationship. The question is, can President Trump take back all that rhetoric or make them forget? I think it's very much an open question.
So that's how the major media is trying to explain the fact that even compared to 8 years ago, I mean, clearly the reception is much, much warmer in Saudi Arabia, or was over the weekend, than it was 8 years ago for President Obama. I mean, this is years before even the nuclear deal. And then, of course, after that, I mean, the last trip that the president made to Saudi Arabia, as that reporter said there, the king wouldn't even come out to meet him. And so now, I mean, it's wide open arms. And the media, in a lot of ways, can't understand it because they think, well, I mean, he had all that strong rhetoric and he said Islam hates us when he was campaigning. So why would they welcome him? And there's another clip. I don't know if I have time to play it, but the same reporter talks about how that, well, President Obama's own father was actually a Muslim. So why wouldn't they receive him better? They can't understand it, given all of the rhetoric on the campaign trail. And they wonder, don't they? They wonder, well, how are they going to make, how is the Trump administration going to make them forget all of those strong statements? See, here again, the whole tone is negative, like we covered there at the start. I think John Bolton, the former UN ambassador, he probably did about the best job over the weekend of explaining why the reception has been so positive in Saudi Arabia. This is clip number 5.
We have an excerpt from today's speech. I want to read a little bit of this for you and get your reaction here. This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people of all regions who seek to protect it. This is a battle between good and evil. What do you make of that?
Well, sounds pretty good to me. I mean, look, the reception that the president has gotten in Saudi Arabia and from other Arab heads of state that he's been meeting with these past 2 days, I think give the lie to the notion that the Islamic world is appalled that he talks about radical Islamic terrorism and a war on terror. I think they understand there in Riyadh exactly what the threat is. So I think this speech will be an interesting one to compare with Barack Obama's famous 2009 speech in Cairo, where the words terror and terrorism did not pass his lips. It's Muslims who have borne the brunt of the damage from radical Islamic terrorism, and they're looking for an America to wake up to the nature of the threat. I think this speech should help that.
Then is there a disconnect with the narrative that we're seeing here at home when they criticize him for being strong on that, for saying it like it is, for calling it radical Islam? You hear many of the mainstream media really picking him apart for that.
Sure. I think that attitude, frankly, is condescending and patronizing toward Muslims. They understand the nature of the struggle that they face. King Abdullah of Jordan, the Muslim king of a Muslim country, has called this struggle a civil war within Islam. Now, that strikes me as a pretty good analysis. If it's good enough for King Abdullah, it's good enough for President Trump, it ought to be good enough for the rest of us.
That's John Bolton on the news over the weekend, talking about why Saudi Arabia has had such a warm welcome for President Trump. Now, again, when we understand Bible prophecy and what it says in Daniel 11 and Psalm 83, you know there's going to be two camps, and you know Germany's going to be more involved, not less, in the months and years ahead. And so I'm not suggesting here that it's just going to revert back to what it was before the Cairo speech in 2009. As my father said, I mean, that speech is going to shake the nations, and the impact from that, it continues. The damage has already been done in so many ways, but clearly the reason why they're welcoming this administration the way they are is because they can appreciate just how dangerous the threat of Iran is. And the last administration was, of course, helping to empower the King of the South. That's what's been happening in these last several years. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, yesterday, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we had another graduation ceremony. I should have added up the number, I guess 2006 was the first year that we graduated seniors. The first year for sophomores would have been back in 2003. So for as far as senior graduations go, it's been over 10 years, 10, 11, 12 years of seniors. It's a small college, God's College, with two small campuses. But the impact that it has on the work, Herbert Armstrong so often said, you can see this all through his autobiography, that as the college grew and expanded, so did the work. And as I was mentioning to a few of us over the weekend here, we've seen a lot of growth in God's College just in the last few years. Of course, you have Ed Stone in particular added to the mix in 2015, not even that long ago. And we've seen growth and development right here on this campus. And certainly we've seen that at the headquarters campus as well. 14 seniors graduated yesterday in Edmond, and we had three more from right here at Ed Stone. I forget the grand total of sophomores that were there graduating from the two-year program as well. But it was just a beautiful, beautiful ceremony from start to finish. We watched it all here live pretty late last night, 9 p.m. for Ed Stone, the live transmission. But it was well worth it, and it went late into the night for us, not only during the ceremony, but then congratulating all of the students soon after. Well, at the end of the ceremony, as per usual, or I guess right in the middle, you had my father's commencement address. And so we'll conclude today's program by playing that address in its entirety.
Good afternoon to all of you. These are great days indeed. This is supposed to be a commencement address that I'm going to give you today. It's a little different than what I would normally give, but I think it's appropriate. We had Melanie Phillips visit here a few days ago. She's probably the best reporter that the London Times has these days. And she also recently wrote a book, The Guardian Angel, and I think some of you have read that and heard about it. But she mentioned something in there I thought was very alarming, and that is that there are some history teachers in Britain that resist the very idea of having to teach British history because they say, well, that's elitist irrelevance. In other words, it's just irrelevant. And I thought that, well, that's, I found it alarming because it was just a few years ago that they were in a war where 60 million people died and their nation almost died. And yet they don't want to study about the man who many people say, many historians say, saved Britain and Europe. And there are historians like William Manchester that say he also saved Western civilization. Now that's recent history, and that's just, nationally you say, well, that seems to me anyhow like it's suicidal, because you want to learn about men like Sir Winston Churchill and leaders like that. If you want to save your nation. Winston Churchill told them, I think this was in the late 30s, but he says there are just terrible preparations that need to be made for this war, and we're not prepared for it. And he said, our people, I don't think, realize how grave these dangers are, the dangers of a world explosion. And in September 1939, the world exploded. If you look around at our world today, you'd have to say, well, it's even worse than what it was then. You have unstable leaders that many people would go beyond just calling unstable. But Churchill said the people were back then were concerned about their daily routine, and they got angry if you somehow interfered with that. But here we are today looking at all these nuclear bombs that are proliferating around the world, and I suppose people even today would be very irritated if you want to talk about something like that. And it isn't a pleasant subject. We know that there is great hope, and our students are taught about that hope. But that's a subject that we just, well, I think even we, some of us, at times would say, well, I'd rather not even think about that. But that problem is about to be solved very soon. Winston Churchill warned Britain throughout the 1930s, and that's not that long ago at all, and yet almost all of the media in Britain were opposed to him and didn't heed what he said, condemned him as well as most members in Parliament. I mean, that's going to the very top. And they didn't want to hear anybody talk about a coming war. And if you look at the history, you'll find that the great BBC, or the British Broadcasting Corporation, which is operates on the taxes of the people, and they wouldn't even let him speak publicly in the 1930s. They're still broadcasting all around the world, and as far as I'm concerned, they didn't learn much from Winston Churchill. But when he finally became prime minister, because everybody saw that he was right in what he said. But it was almost too late. And you think about all those millions of people that died. And Churchill said that was a totally unnecessary war. If we had had the will to do something when we had the power, and Hitler didn't have that much power, and we would have stopped him when we should have. But that didn't happen. And here you have teachers in Britain standing up and saying that they will have none of that British history. And if that doesn't alarm people, it should. It certainly should. They failed to learn a lesson, and I wanted to give you a few quotes here that I think are really critical. This is from Isaiah Berlin. And he said, Mr. Churchill's dominant category, the single central organizing principle of his moral and intellectual universe, is an historical imagination. Well, how do you get something like that? A historical imagination, so strong, so comprehensive as to encase the whole of the present and the whole of the future in a framework of a rich and a multicolored past. The whole of the present and the whole of the future, and in a framework of a rich and multicolored past. That's, I think, something we can understand. And he went on to say that when Winston Churchill sees these nations around, especially in Europe, he has all these vivid images in his mind because he knows so much about history. He really, really was steeped in history, and said, if you don't learn history, you're going to end up having terrible problems and probably lose your nation. Isaiah Berlin said, imagination, if they are filled with sufficient energy and force of will, sometimes transforms the outlook of an entire people and generation. Mr. Churchill's political imagination has something of the same magical power to transform. There is something about a historical imagination where people can be transformed by it if you really help them to see. They can be transformed. Their whole lives can be changed by that historical imagination. And that's exactly what Churchill did to an entire nation. Now, there were a lot of good people in Britain, but they didn't think like Winston Churchill, and he had to persuade them that they or were going to have to if they were going to survive. And this same author says, Mr. Churchill has his strongest sense is the sense of the past, the clear, brightly colored vision of history. And he gone on again to say, well, look, and this is critical here. He said, as his history of the war shows, he has an immense capacity for absorbing facts, but they emerge transformed. I mean, he's not just winging it. He's not just, let's say, being abstract. He has just an immense capacity for absorbing facts. And then he works on that with his mind, and they come out transformed, and then they transform people. He did that in an amazing way in World War II, like no leaders ever have that in this modern time. He was certainly the man of World War II. If imagination is, it says in Webster's, the act or power of forming mental images of what is not present. And now that takes some doing, but you can do that with imagination. Churchill said, look, we need to go back in history and look at those heroic men and those heroic virtues and learn from them. He says, if we flout them, our nations are doomed to decay and dissolution. Now, in other words, they teach you by example. I just think those are some powerful statements. And how can a country learn so little from their own past and now have a hostility, or even maybe it goes beyond that, not wanting to teach British history? That is just contemptuous in my mind, and I think the mind of many others. But look, when you go back and you study the life, let's say, of Winston Churchill, your imagination is stirred. It is stirred, and you're moved, and I think in my own life, in some ways, I have been transformed by what that man believed and what he did with his words and what he did with his deeds. A remarkable man, and I think God had a hand in preparing him, but nevertheless, he was a great man. And he helped me to work on trying to understand, let's say, what historical imagination is really all about. Einstein said one time that imagination is greater than knowledge. And I think in many ways that's true. We really do need to have a historical imagination. In other words, an imagination that's just full of all the history, the important history that we can possibly absorb. And if you apply your, it will stimulate your imagination. He came with a different attitude than anybody else on the world scene. There was nobody like Winston Churchill, and nobody understood history like he did. That's how he got his imagination on all those historical facts. Santayana said that those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Condemned to repeat it. Churchill sort of refined that somewhat. And he said that you should go and look at the errors of the former years and see what that will teach you about the future. Henry Steele Commager wrote and said that history was both memory and prophecy. Now that's, if you, after all, you'd have to say, if you can learn about prophecy, well, that ought to really inflame your imagination. And here, he just flat out says, talking about Winston Churchill, that history is prophecy. Does that make sense? He says we have the long view both of the past and the future. But if you go back and look at history, you could say, well, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that they made a lot of mistakes. Sometimes they made horrible mistakes, lost wars because of it. And incidentally, Winston Churchill wrote the history of World War I and World War II, But he not only wrote the history, he told them how they should have fought the war instead of the way they did. That they people, historians just don't normally write that way because he had this historical imagination. But he said, look, if you go back and you examine your history, you can see that there obviously are times when you've made horrible mistakes, horrible errors. And there are other times when you did it right, like when he was ruling, frankly. You have to make a choice. And then when you look at that, well, you begin to understand, well, hey, if we do it this way, we're going to make some horrifying mistakes. And if we do it the other way, you have a choice, then we will excel and we will win. And you can learn those lessons. And really, that's how you stir up your historical imagination. So much is there in history to teach us. And when you have that kind of imagination, Henry Steele Commager said, you are going to transform people. Transform them. Not in a bad way, but in this case, in a marvelous way. Commager wrote, Churchill grapples with the problem of historical perspective. Incidents have one meaning at the time of their occurrence and another when they have become part of history. Isn't that right? Well, you say, oh boy, we had this view when we were fighting it, and then after they write it down in history, well, it happened very differently than what we thought. Many people have called Mr. Churchill a prophet. Here is the main reason. He tried to, quote, assess the ultimate significance of events in a historical perspective. Well, of course, he saw it through all that history he was steeped in. He saw World War II through that prism. That's how he viewed it. Mr. Churchill also said that the further you see into the past, the further you can see into the future. And that's why he was a prophet, why people called him a prophet. It was just that he knew history, so much of it, and all those facts really helped him to build this historical imagination. And imagination does really make some changes. Look at this. Do you think Britain ought to be teaching this? Four times Britain had fought to rescue Europe from the grip of a tyrant. Louis XIV, Napoleon, Kaiser William, and Hitler. Now, these teachers that say now that, well, that's just elitist irrelevance for you to want me to teach our history. Well, now, if your country has saved Europe that many times, saved nations, don't you think you ought to learn how they did it and how, let's say, the bad guys arose and maybe almost destroyed the good guys in this case? Well, there's also a prophetic imagination which goes beyond that, but I won't get into that today. George Will said that, and he was really quoting another great historian, French historian Tocqueville, and he said that when people look at a democracy, they don't realize, the historians today just look like, well, you've got these impersonal forces and it's coming at you and there isn't anything you can do to change it. And he said, history can be turned in its course by great individuals. You can change the whole course of history. Churchill proved that. Now, I'm not worshiping the man. I'm just looking at the facts. He proved that. And you think about this one example I'll give you in France. Was the ally of Britain in World War II. They surrendered, and they were going to surrender their navy to the Germans, and it could have been decided the outcome of the war. And Churchill ordered that, okay, he wanted them to give all that to Britain, but they didn't, and they wouldn't, and he ordered the British Navy to go and destroy as much of the French Navy as they could, and a lot of, well, hundreds and hundreds of French soldiers and naval personnel. Now, you just imagine in your mind, use your historical imagination, and say, well, okay, what are you going to do? There was an uproar in the world, and everybody was condemning Churchill for doing that. And until you read about it later in history, they say, well, it really was the right decision. Now, if you were to sit down with a Democratic committee and try to say, now, hey, we've got to decide whether or not to destroy the French Navy, what do you think? And they'd begin to talk about that. You know what they decide. They'd say, well, that's insane. But Churchill knew that they were fighting for their survival. He knew that. And really, those were great days indeed. Great days. How we need leadership in this world. Churchill not only wrote history, but he told them how they should have fought the wars, because he was a warrior and he'd been in a lot of battles, and he knew how it all worked. Well, today you can find all kinds of surveys where some of our colleges don't even require one course in history. So those people, they're you know what is going to happen there? They're lost in the present. They're lost in the present because of people who don't know what they're talking about when they teach or don't teach history. I want to read you this in conclusion here. I think this is one of the most dramatic conclusions of any volume in a book. Churchill wrote 6 volumes of World War II. And here is the conclusion to Volume 1. He was writing about it, looking back, and he wrote about how he had to form a government. They decided, well, he was the only man to rule them. And he wrote about this at the conclusion of Volume 1 of the history of World War II. There are 6 volumes. Notice this, what he said. I just think this is amazing. He said, and you've heard it before probably, but listen, and hear it again. It'll help your historical imagination. He says, I cannot conceal from you, the reader of this truthful account, that as I went to bed about 3 a.m., I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. 11 years in the political wilderness had freed me from ordinary party antagonisms. My warnings over the last 6 years had been so numerous, so detailed, and were now so terribly vindicated that no one could gainsay me. His warning had that historical imagination. And nobody, and finally, you see, it transformed Britain. It transformed them. And Britain was saved and the West was saved. But he goes on to say, I could not be reproached either for making the war or with the want of preparation for it. And they weren't prepared for it. And they had almost nothing to fight with when he took over as ruler of Britain. He said, I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure I would not fail. And he says that he went to bed that night, he slept soundly that night, and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams. The way he was viewing it, that's absolutely true. Facts are better than dreams, better than hazy dreams by some teachers who don't want to teach and refuse to teach history at all if they can get their way. Churchill took those facts and made it his historical imagination and changed the lives of all the British people, almost all of them, which is phenomenal in itself. And that imagination was built on facts, historical facts, not abstract dreams with no real validity. He had developed a historical imagination, and the evidence is there. You can prove it. All you have to do is just know the history, study the history, and you see that here is a man that had a historical imagination and transformed a whole nation in a time of crisis when they almost had to listen or die, and he did it through his words and through his actions. So if you will build your imagination on historical facts, you students, you young people, you're going to be able to help change the course of history and change this world to what it should have been a long, long time ago. And that's, I think, something that we all need to be a part of.